Right. Welcome back, young lady. It's nice to have you back on the show.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right, what are we going to talk about today?
Probably injuries and how they can happen just literally right before your eyes. In 2 seconds, you can be in hospital needing an operation.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
It is.
What are you thinking of? Oh, that's our cat on the roof. What are you thinking of?
Probably how my little brother, just a couple of weeks ago, injured his finger, slammed it in a car door and had to go to A&E. Literally where we were just meant to be going to my school for a workshop.
I know, you know what? It was actually really disturbing. It was like I shut the door and on the other side, suddenly I heard some screaming and it was awful. Just like that, 1 second, boom. But his finger's okay. But we did need to go to the emergency ER room, have it cleaned, dressed up.
Luckily, it was our mum who did it.
I know, we're quite lucky that way, aren't we? She's quite a good doctor.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, I've witnessed lots of injuries like this, things that can happen in literally seconds. And it makes you realize how fragile we are and how delicate we are as a human being. You don't want to be squished or fall or hurt yourself, because then once you get injured, boom, suddenly you're disabled. You can't write, you can't walk, you can't drive. And all these things you just take for granted, like getting up from a chair, lying down, walking down to your shops. You can't do it anymore. So yeah, you don't want to get injured, do you?
No.
Have you had any injuries?
Quite a few.
Oh.
5, basically. But much more, but I can't count them all.
Like what? I can't even remember. Like,
so they're much more probably like falling down, falling off my scooter, falling off my bike. But the ones that I can definitely remember is I also injured my finger, same way that my brother did. Into car door, same hand, same car.
Oh, wow. Something about that door. I'm not coming out of that door. I'm not slamming that door shut. Someone else can do. What other injuries?
So I didn't do this one. I just woke up one morning and I couldn't move it.
Move what?
My thumb. It was just trapped in like a crouched position.
It was bent, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I couldn't move it at all. So I had to get an operation on that. I still have a scar on my thumb.
Yeah, that's called a trigger thumb. Yeah. I was there with you in the hospital all day. I was holding you and you were very brave. Were you nervous?
I really can't remember. So all I can remember is walking into the hospital and going into the room. That's all I can remember.
Well, that's not a bad memory.
That was like when I was 5 or something, 3.
Yeah, you're young. You're 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Since I was really young.
Even younger than now. Well, you know this podcast that I've recorded, it's actually a vet is talking about how to look after your pets. And I got all my supporters to ask questions and I asked those questions to the vet. I mean, I think the only thing I really disagreed or not on the same page as him was about vaccinating your pets and animals. But we've got quite a lot of pets. We've got some visiting pets. What do you think of our honeymoon couple?
Yeah, the ducks.
Yeah.
They come around every day, basically, except for once. We didn't know where they were. And they come around like 5 times a day. And it's really sweet. So it's a mommy mallard and a daddy mallard. The mommy one we think is pregnant. And so they like to come over, have a little rest. We've even given them names.
What are the names?
The mummy one is called Pam.
Okay.
From Migration.
All right.
And the daddy one, me and my sister can't decide on. Either Matt or Dax. Both are from Migration.
What about Ricardo?
Ricardo.
Ricardo. Yeah.
Really random.
They are so cute, aren't they?
Just eating away at the oats, right? Literally just throw at them.
Yep, yep, yep. I think they're very well-fed ducks. I like pets.
Yeah. So they give you comfort, happiness, Sometimes when I'm upset at I lie in my bed under my blanket, then I feel something just slightly tiptoeing on top of me. So then I gently fold over my blanket, and then our cat's still just above me, like literally about to bite up my nose. And then like baby just curl up next to me, and but it's really cute and sweet. And then it always puts me in a better mood.
Yeah. I was going to say there's something very comforting and healing about having a cat or a dog, you know, a pet that you can stroke that comes up and...
But I'm not really a dog person, that's all.
You're not a dog person?
No.
I think eventually, one day I will be a dog person.
So I think one day, but right now they're not really my thing. So I like dogs, like cute and cuddly, but some dogs are just like too yappy and too energetic for me.
Right. No, I don't want a little dog. Like when you grow up one day and you leave the house, I think I'd like to have a medium-sized dog. I think I want a quiet, strong, like loyal dog. Like
punch, punch.
No, not punch, punch. Like just like a, you know, a strong dog that, you know, no one will mess with. You know, what's that, Rhodesian something, Ridgeback or something like that? I don't know if that's the name. It's a very beautiful dog. But right now, no, I've got you three puppies, so I don't need that.
11 chickens, 2 cats, 4 stick insects, and 2 visiting mallards.
It is a Rhodesian Ridgeback. It's a beautiful dog.
Did you just look that up on your phone?
On the laptop, yeah, I just looked it up. It's a beautiful dog. Very nice. I'll show you afterwards. It's gorgeous. Yeah, I'm going to get one of those. I just want to say to my... listeners and supporters. Well, the supporters, I'd like to say thank you so much for supporting me and, making this show viable and just having, you know, faith in what I do and showing that love. And, you know, I really appreciate it. And to all the listeners who are thinking, do you know what? I love Amma's content, but you're not actually subscribing. Please do. You know, I need all this. I need all the support I can get. It makes a huge difference. So I just want to say thanks to a few of my recent subscribers. Andrew Bevan, I like your videos and your honesty. I'm unjabbed as far as COVID goes. Had my last flu jab about 5 years ago. Well done, buddy. Margie Latham, thanks for continuing the good fight for the truth to be revealed. As a retired registered nurse in New Zealand, I've been horrified by what has gone on over the past few years, and I've truly woken up to what medicine is really all about. Keep up the great work. I like this one. This one is from John Q. Liberty. Rage on, Dr. Malik. Excited to join your team. We're calling it clan now. But yeah, John, thank you. I will rage on. And what do you think? Do you have any messages to say to anyone?
Probably, please do subscribe to my dad's show.
Oh, that's nice.
Sometimes he can be a little bit crazy, but please do subscribe. It will really help us look after us and have much more of a happy life and much more of a free life.
Oh, baby. We're already... quite free though, aren't we?
Yes, but not free, but not quite free enough to get right into the wide open. That's our dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
Get our own farm of our own, get our like 3 or 5 houses on it so we can all live there together.
That'd be nice.
I like some dogs, I would grow our own food, everything.
Well, first of all, I'd love to pay off this goddamn mortgage. That's freedom. But yeah, I mean, That's a dream. You should always have a dream, my love.
Dream is hope, and dreams are happiness.
Yeah, and it's also being grateful and having gratitude for what we have now. You know what gratitude means, doesn't it?
Yeah, like to be grateful, to be happy with what you got. So sure, we could want maybe like something else, but don't like need it. It's like, yeah, maybe you might want to get, like, let's say you have an empty house with, like, a sofa, a dining room table, a kitchen with a fridge and an oven and a bed. And like, you don't have enough money. Yeah, I'm like, you want to put a picture up. Don't be like, I hate my house because it doesn't have that picture. I want to get that picture. It's better than my own house. Don't be like that. Just be grateful with what you have. Yeah, you can have something more. Just don't be desperate for it.
Don't let it consume you.
Don't let it take over.
Yeah, live your life now and enjoy what you have. You can dream. You can dream and want to have more. There's nothing wrong with that.
And you could eventually get that more. You could eventually get it.
There's a lot of people who actually have got quite a lot, got a lot of money, got a lot of possessions, and actually are not happy. Did you know that?
Yeah. So we always just want more. So the more you have, the little you get.
All right, we're going a bit off sidetrack, but I think
So this was meant to be injuries, and now we're going to gratefulness.
Yeah. But the thing is, I think that goes to show you that happiness is more than having physical possessions and money. What is happiness to you?
To have family. Family just keeps you on the right track. They watch out for you. You watch out for them. Just family. Family gives you everything.
It does. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining the show again. Everyone, I hope you enjoy the Roger Meacock podcast. It's going to be part one and part two. Part one is free. Part two is going to be for my paid subscribers only. See, that's what happens if you're a paid subscriber. You get all the extra content. So subscribe to my show, like my young daughter has said. And everyone enjoy. Right, everyone listening, I just want to say before we dive into this podcast, those of you listening on Apple Podcast, you might have noticed there's some podcasts missing. And that's because those ones are behind a paywall. And the way I upload the podcast is actually through Spotify. So they don't do the paid subscriptions with other platforms. So I'm afraid if you want to listen to the paywall episodes, and there are fantastic ones there, you need to go either to Spotify or to my Substack and subscribe to either one of those or both, because I would love the money. Basically, if you go to Spotify and you're using an Apple phone, it often doesn't work. The payment doesn't go through. That's because Apple is annoying. So quite often, if you can go to a computer or a laptop and log into Spotify there, you can then set up the subscription. That's all I wanted to say, because I've had quite a lot of emails from people saying, I can't subscribe and I can't see it. And you're all listening on Apple Podcast. So I'm sorry. It means moving platform, but there's no way I can work around it because Spotify and Apple don't work together. They don't have a mutual agreement to share, the subscriptions. So that is the problem. Right. Now that I've said that and got that off my chest, I also want to say thank you to all the recent subscriptions. I freaking love you. Seriously. 3-4 months ago, I was pretty depressed. But you guys have just given me a lifeline, and I'm just overwhelmed by the support and the love from all of you people out there listening. I fucking love you. Right. Now, we have Roger Meacock back in my studio. Hello.
Hi, Ahmad. Lovely to see you again. You know, you've been a good mate since we spoke last time, and we've kept in contact. And, I love that. You know, this has been a good journey, and I love connecting with people. That's one of the things that I really look forward to, and it helps keep me going, keeps me sane to a certain degree. Yeah,
thanks, man. You know, honestly, I feel the same way. Like, I've kept in touch regularly now with probably 2/3 of my guests, and I think of you, all of you, as my friends, and it's really nice. And like you, I need that social interaction. I was talking to one of my listeners just before you came, Judith Coking, God bless her. She's lovely. She just actually lives quite nearby to me. She rang me to say, I just wanted to make sure you're okay, and because I know you don't talk to that many people anymore. And it's true, because when I was a doctor practicing, I was seeing about 20, 30 patients a week. And I love meeting people. I love hearing their individual stories. I love that connection. It's fuel for my soul. And now I'm having 3-4 guests come a week. And that's it. So that's a massive drop in my level of interactions with people. And yes, I'm speaking to a lot of people over the phone and emailing my supporters and listeners. But it's not the same as, you know, physically being in the presence of someone else. And I kind of miss that. So you, just talking to you is actually really helpful for me too.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And, you know, I'm same as you, really. I mean, because of my work and how I've been in the past, you know, I was doing a lot of driving. I mean, I was doing sort of 50,000 miles a year in the car, wow, which is a lot of the time on your own in the car with Boots, obviously. But he's not a great conversationist. And there's times when if I have if I go and do a talk, the following day, my voice is really tired because I'm not one of these people that, you know, into a small talk, you know, I haven't got something important, meaningful to say. I tend not to say anything. And it doesn't mean I don't appreciate, you know, the company of who I'm with. It's just like, you know, I just don't do small talk. It's just not how my brain works. And I'd rather have a meaningful conversation and just appreciate someone's presence, you know. But a consequence of that, and obviously living on my own as well, is I just hardly talk to people. And so my voice has lost, I suppose, that endurance. And it does get tired quickly and easily, and we need to do something about that.
So it's funny, I've had very few people say I talk too much. So I was going to say, right, I'm not going to talk at all in this podcast. I'm going to say, so pressure's all on you, buddy.
No promise, no pressure. But I suppose what tends to happen then, because I am a sociable person as well, then probably when I do see people, they will go, bloody hell, he didn't stop talking. And it's not, I probably don't, maybe I don't, but it's that I just talk to so few people these days that, you know, when you get the opportunity to talk to people, and obviously a lot of people want to discuss things, then, you know, you end up just taking the opportunity while you can.
You're not alone. So, I've spoken to so many now of my supporters, right? I reach out to them, ring them, chat to them. And sometimes it can be quite a flood. They're like, talking to me. And it's because we've all been cut off, isolated.
Yeah.
And it's a worldwide problem. Like, I think it's deliberate and accidental. Like, COVID was deliberate, the way they locked us all down and isolated us. But also just social media, phones, our work, how busy we are, the way the society is organized. We don't meet and commute and talk to people like in a train or bus. We're all just stuck on these screens looking down. And it's quite sad. So you could be surrounded by lots of people, but you're very lonely. You're just isolated. It's kind of bizarre. And I think that's really sad. And we've also been like programmed to fear people, like strangers, when actually it's quite nice to strike up a conversation and just start talking to people and realize how much you've got in common or learn from them. Yeah. I like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I find that. I'm a social person. And I take Boots for a walk. You know, if I see somebody, I always say hello, which, you know, is quite strange for some parts of the country. I think it's, you know, very much more common up north.
Yes.
And certainly in London, you know, if you say hello to people when you meet them in the street, they sort of look down and say, oh, what's he looking at me for? You know, sort of rabbit in the headlights, which on one level I find quite amusing. But on another level, it is sad because obviously, you know, grew up in a time when we didn't have tech. When I was a kid, I didn't get a mobile phone until I'd actually left university. And, you know, you sort of went through life interacting with people on a really regular basis and looking up and seeing what's going, noticing what's going on around you. And, you know, I sort of think it's when I drive around, obviously, having done that many miles, it's a lot of them on motorway miles, and you can see how the standard of driving has gone down. And I think part of it is, you know, when we were kids and we were going on, you know, that long trip down for holidays down to Devon or Cornwall or wherever we were going, that, you know, to pass the time of day, there wasn't any screens to look at when you're in the car or, you know, the radio was on, but the only other thing you could do is look out the window and, you know, play games like spot the red car and count how many red cars you've seen, or caravans or something, you know, something just to try and occupy the kids. And but the consequence of that was we actually learnt roadcraft. And obviously then we were kids and we all had a bicycle, and you went out on the bike, and in the summer holidays you might be out on the bike, you know, hours at a time.
Yeah.
You know, you might have to come back and, you know, check it every so often just so that, you know, they knew you hadn't been kidnapped or killed, but or run over. But at least, you know, but you learnt roadcraft. And I think everybody who drives should actually learn how to ride a bicycle first and learn roadcraft and realise what it's like to be the little guy on the road. And then there'll be a lot more tolerance of everybody. So, yeah, it's things have changed, and not ways technology, you know, it has advantages, obviously, but in some ways it has reduced our interactions with other people in a way that I'm not sure is, I know it's not, it's not good. There's no not sure about it. It isn't good. And, you know, people have lost that ability to interact. And as a consequence, then people have become sensitized to being, you know, offended. And it's like, no, I've got a different opposition, you know, a different point of view to you, but it's a valid one. I can back it up. If you can back yours up, that's fine. You know, we might shift our position slightly, but at least even if we decide to stay the same, we've got an appreciation of another perspective. And I can still go down and have a drink with you, and I won't be offended by that. And, you know, being offended is my problem. You know, it's my reaction to something. And actually, you can choose whether you're offended or not. And 100%. a lot of it is the intent behind. And if there's obviously no intent, then if someone says something that's offensive, it's not intended. So don't take it as an offense. You know, it's just, that's, you know, that's just how it is. And it's that, I think that's, that lack of social interaction has created that situation where people don't understand that, and that's where offense becomes, and then it's become a thing, and then people go, oh, I can use this offense, I'm offended idea as leverage to try and get my way. And actually that's not what it's all about. It's actually, you know, we need to go through life and appreciate other people for their differences, because ultimately variety is the spice of life. And, you know, we need to applaud and celebrate people's differences, not try to make us all the same and think the same and be the same. I mean, we might as well be robots and automatons and transhumanists, you know. It's we need to, you know, be who we are, and but have the confidence to be who you are, knowing that you're not, you know, no one's going to worry about it. You don't have to be self-conscious about it. You could be confident about being yourself, because, you know, it's not a problem. It's not a problem.
I know. Right, listen, I want to dive in to some questions.
Okay.
So last time round, everybody said, Roger Meacock's a really nice guy, but you didn't talk much about pet stuff. And there were nicely, very, very polite emails and feedback, but basically saying, next time, can you just talk less about other shit and just get to the nitty gritty? And I was like, oh, okay. Because they clearly recognized that you were ethical, you were kind, you were genuine, you're authentic, and they wanted to tap into your knowledge. Okay. So this time, as you know, I went to all my Substack subscribers and said, hey, what should we ask this natural vet? And I got quite a lot of questions. As you know, because you've got access to my Substack, it kind of falls into a few common themes. But let's just start, right? Let's just start.
Okay.
I've got Crosscat here. She goes, I'm a retired GP, so I know about human diseases, but I don't know about animal diseases.
Yeah.
Please ask them to describe the diseases that our cats and dogs are vaccinated against, and then ask them, what do they know about the safety and efficacy of those vaccines?
There, okay, go, well, we're going to start with the biggie, with vaccination.
Yes, biggie.
It is a biggie, and it's
controversial.
And it's controversial. And, you know, that it sort of has that parallel with the human side. I would say from the beginning, there is no one simple answer. And the reason for that really comes down to how we keep animals in a much more concentrated way in terms of animals per unit mile, if you like, or square mile, compared to how they would naturally be in the wild. So I think we've got to bear that in mind. And so that there are some instances where I would, even though I'm would absolutely against vaccinations, there are times when I would actually say, you've got to consider your position and where you are and where you live and what's going on around you. So if, for example, take dogs, parvovirus causes a very nasty enteritis and puppies die. And the same with all the animal vaccinations. They are primarily a disease that affects the young.
Disease or infection?
Infections, you know.
Because they're separate things. Yeah. Infections come and go.
Infections cause disease, don't they? So they're an infection that primarily affects the young. And so they might need some early cover as kittens or puppies, especially in a sort of an inner city situation, because, as I say, we've concentrated animals to have a much more dense population per square mile. And parvovirus can kill, you know, and all the regular vets who are first opinion work, especially in inner city area, you know, areas where they're covering, they will see parvovirus and they will have had dogs who have died from it. And so from that point of view, they will say, yes, dogs do need to be covered for parvovirus because it can, okay. It can kill.
So look, I'm sorry, I'm going to interject there. I want to home it in a little bit. Look, I know you need to put a disclaimer out there, but I'm going to say it very clearly. I question all vaccines now, human and animal. I'm sorry. I just question the quality of the studies. I don't think I've seen any good quality studies, proper randomized studies, proper placebo. I haven't seen anything like that. So having read things like Turtles All the Way Down and Dissolving Illusions, very skeptical, frankly. I'm very, very skeptical. Now, I'm aware that you might not want to be saying certain things and you might believe certain things. That's great. And I'll respect that. But can we just focus on the question, like, what diseases are actually affected by, you know, affect dogs and then cats? What are the diseases? And then what vaccines do they offer them?
Okay, so dogs, you've got various different vaccines. You've got core vaccines.
No, let's start with the diseases.
Yeah, I'll come to that. I'll explain why.
Okay.
Okay, so you've got your core vaccines, which is parvovirus, which is primarily an enteric disease. You know, they get the squits, very watery diarrhea, and obviously dehydration can kill. You've got distemper, which doesn't, it's pretty rare in the UK. It hasn't really, you know, it's very rare in the UK. It causes hard pad, causes neurological problems.
Hard pad?
Yeah, they get thickening of the skin on the eyes, on the eyelids and on the feet, and ulceration on the body as well. So
distemper?
Yeah.
Okay.
So not nice, but rare. And then you've got infectious hepatitis, which is obviously inflammation of the liver. And again, you get mild or severe disease as a result of that.
Sorry, is the distemper an infection?
It's caused by a virus. They're caused by viruses.
Okay.
So the problem that we have is a lot of, you know, the vets would say that a lot of those diseases have become a lot less in incidence as a result of vaccination. So I think vaccines do have some ability to give some immunity, but they are not 100% cover. And there are some benefits, as I say, in inner city places where dogs are being concentrated, where they're more likely to meet those infections. And the counter to that, obviously, is in the countryside, where dogs perhaps aren't being walked in the same density. They go to, you know, woods, and there might be only three or four dogs that walk there. And so you could say there's no such thing as zero risk. So there are risks to having disease. Mm. There are risks to having vaccinations. Mm. And there are risks in terms of how likely you are to meet those viruses and get the disease. And there are also then risks in terms of if they have the vaccination, it might not even take in the first place. So, and then you've got the whole timing aspect of when vaccinations are given. And I think they're given far too young generally. So when we're born, and certainly when animals are born, their immune system is naive. That's why there are maternal antibodies in the colostrum.
Yeah.
And that if they get good colostrum in you know the first 24 hours before the gut closes up, they get maternal antibodies. So it's not their body that's produced the antibodies, it's antibodies that they have absorbed from their mother's colostrum. And they will persist. And in dogs, that can persist up to 25 weeks. Rarely over 15 weeks, but they can persist up to 25 weeks. So that gives the young puppy or kitten gives them immune cover if they encounter those infections. So then you've got the situation where, unfortunately, I think vaccines are given far too early. In some cases, they're starting at sort of 6 or 8 weeks, and then they get repeated because they realise that with the maternal antibodies there, they're going to take out the vaccinations. So which has two adverse effects from what I can see. One is you're giving a vaccine with all the adjuvants that we know can cause potential adverse reactions. But you're giving it into a situation where actually the body naturally fights the vaccine anyway. So you've got to keep repeating it until you think that they've got no more maternal antibodies. So, but giving that vaccine at that early age actually takes out the maternal antibodies because they can't be reproduced. So you're actually reducing the body's defenses whilst you're giving those first boosts, you know, the first injections. And then you're having to go back and keep giving them until you think that the maternal antibody has stopped. I mean, traditionally, you know, the sort of second or third jabs are given every 2 weeks. Thereafter, but they, you know, usually stop at about 12 weeks old. So you could say, well, that's under 15 weeks, so there's still maybe maternal antibodies present, but all you've sequentially done is actually reduce maternal antibodies on the way. So I think we do vaccinate too early. And that's obviously, you know, the idea is to have the maximum cover with a minimal intervention.
So when should they be vaccinated?
I would say, I would think at the earliest 12 weeks, but that's not common at all. There'll be very few, and it's almost.
So when do they normally vaccinate?
But most commonly, probably at 8 weeks old. And very often the breeder will have done it before the puppies get handed over to the new owners. And then the owners will have to then go to their own vet and get the second ones done.
Can you buy a pet without any vaccines?
That's something that people, I would advise people talk to the breeder before, you know, before they get the puppy and have the discussion.
Because some might have a philosophical or belief or whatever that they don't want their pet to be vaccinated.
Absolutely. You know, and I think, you know, as I said, if you have a dog living in the countryside, the chances of you encountering these diseases is that much lower. It's not risk-free, but there are that much lower. And you could argue that the level of challenge they're going to get in the countryside as well is going to be that much lower. And if you've got a strong, healthy dog, because you're feeding it properly, then you know their natural immune system will successfully fight the vast majority of those diseases, and a natural immunity would build up.
So I'm going to interject. We've got so many things to go through, and yeah. I've got lots of questions. So very, very quickly. So we've got in dogs, we've got canine distemper, we've got the parvo, the enteric diarrhea type thing,
yep.
And then we've got hepatitis.
Yep.
Anything else in dogs?
There are non-core vaccines, so leptospirosis, and that's one that's probably been the most controversial in recent years because there used to be L2, so leptospira's got various sits. Because their spirochetes are not bacteria, they're broken up into different groups called cirrhovirs, and there's no cross protection across the different serovars. So originally there was just L2, which covered two of them. And then they recent years, they've introduced the L4, one of which only, so the two extra ones, one of which only...
Leptospirosis.
So it is only found in the States, and it's very low in the UK. And there've been quite a lot of reports of adverse reactions to the L4, certainly more so than the L2. But because it's non-core, you know, it's not regarded as essential. But then because leptospirosis can be carried by rats, then it tends to get pushed as the one that if you're going to have one, this should be the one that you should have. And yet what happens with it is it doesn't actually stop infection. It just stops the symptoms. So you could argue that actually what you're doing is making the dogs into
carriers,
into silent carriers.
Yeah.
For the few cases that there are. And then there's parainfluenza, and then there's kennel cough, which a lot of people have heard about. But the kennel cough one, you know, they can shed kennel cough after they've had it, and then other dogs in the area will pick it up. And again, you know, they're not fatal at the most level that dogs will have them, especially when they're adults. So I say that the biggest threat is for the youngsters, you know, the real young ones, while their immune systems are still developing. So I would say in an inner city area where there's perhaps going to be a denser challenge, the first, you know, do the vaccination as late as possible, which means you can't then take your dog out or let your cat out where it's going to be meeting a challenge before it's been vaccinated, because otherwise you are risking it having an infection that could kill it. So you obviously don't want that, but you want to give the minimal number of vaccinations to get the immune status so that they are safe to go out. So you time it late, and once you've done that first set of puppy vaccinations, there is lots of evidence to say you do not need to booster it beyond that. And that's where I would differ from obviously the mainstream.
I've got a few more questions. So how many are there, like, for dog, how many vaccines do they say to a puppy? Like, the human schedule is massive now. You know, how many, are we talking about 5-6 vaccines now they're offering to the puppies, or is it just one or two? How does it work?
They're sort of all combined into one. So you get the DHPPI, which is like, so all of them in one, and then that's mixed, and then it sort of comes as a dry, and then you mix it with the lepto, which is a liquid one. And then, so everything gets given in the one shot, as it were. So you're not.
But how many vaccines in total are we talking about in that one shot?
Yeah. Parvo, distemper, infectious hepatitis, parainfluenza, and lepto. So five.
Five. Okay. So, coming back to just the idea of vaccines, like, we've been around, dogs have been around for hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years. There weren't vaccines around. Dogs have survived.
Yep.
Hear me through this. And the way the immune system works is, like you said, it needs to be trained.
Yep.
You get exposed to something, your body remembers, you create an immune response and memory cells and all that kind of stuff. And that's how it works. And, you know, when you isolate a group for a long period of time and they're not exposed to the rest of the world, and they're vulnerable to that first contact, just like the Native Americans and the South Americans, you know.
Indeed.
Wipe them all out. So what I'm trying to say is, like, to me, vaccines goes against the natural way that we should be training our immune system. Like, you know, when you got measles as a kid, we used to go to measles parties and meet other kids, and all of us get infected so that we had that immune system. It wasn't that, you know, if you shelter and isolate, actually that's not really great, because then you're not training. Do you remember the kids, like, when we were growing up, that kid in the bubble?
Yeah.
That couldn't be exposed to anybody because they didn't have an immune. It's like that. Like, if you do that and you never get exposed to anything, you're going to get sick. You know, your body isn't capable of launching an immune reaction or fight back. So why don't we just get the puppies meeting other dogs and animals? And, you know, what is the actual risk of them getting an infection and dying? You know, if you got a dog, you didn't vaccinate, you took them out, I mean, is it a 1% chance they're going to die of distemper or some enteric disease? Is it 0.1%? What's the actual risk?
I don't know the figures of it, but I absolutely 100% agree with everything that you've said there. You know, but again, I'd put that idea that would be perfect, and I think perfectly reasonable to have that viewpoint and that practice in the countryside situation. Because if you think back to it, you know, when dogs roamed and lived wild, they probably had their own hunting territories and they had their own packs. You see it on the David Attenborough programs, you know, you've got the hunting dogs in Africa and they've got their own territories. And occasionally, they'll have a battle with their neighboring ones, but that's their only interactions. They've all stayed the same and they're all in the same area. So what we've done differently with domesticating dogs is we've concentrated more dogs into a much smaller area, and therefore the challenge that they are likely to meet when they are very young and the immune system isn't fully developed is therefore considerably higher than they would naturally meet in the wild. The other difference is breeders sell dogs and they'll travel miles to their new surroundings. So in the wild, they will have their own, exactly like the native people that you said, you know, they will be okay in their own groups because they've got their own immunity that's unique to that environment where they are, where they're living and all the rest of it. But once something strange comes in, that's when, you know, they got wiped out. Mm. And so we, to a certain degree, we artificially do that by how dogs are spread around the countryside from a puppy. The litter won't always stay, and very frequently won't stay in the area where it's lived. And of course, we know the different variants of viruses. So, you know, the variation that the maternal antibody has got a certain level of blanket cover, but it won't necessarily cover all strains. And the same with the vaccination. So there's only a certain number of strains that you can have in the vaccine. So there are situations where even if your dog has been vaccinated against parvovirus, they can still get parvovirus from a slightly different strain. And so, as I say, there is no such thing as zero risk. And it's managing that risk and taking into consideration how domestication has changed that concentration. And as I'd say, you know, a city situation where you've got more dogs, perhaps only got two or three parks that they can all, you know, be exercised in. So they're going to meet a much higher potential, you know, concentration.
Okay. I mean, what I would say is, but, you know, domestication precedes vaccination. And, you know, what was the problem? I think you talk about risk, and I agree 100%. It's all about weighing up the risks, 100%. But what would really help with a decision-making is knowing, quantifying it. So what is the actual risk? And like you said, you don't know. And I think no one really knows. So, and the problem is no one really does the research. There's no interest in it because big pharma pushes just take the vaccine. And what would really be useful is you weigh up that risk. You know, so if someone says to me, oh, you know what, the risk of your cat getting this disease is 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, if they don't have the vaccine, I'm like, well, that's all right, I can live with that. But if they say, oh, but there's a risk of your cat dying 1 in 10 if they don't get the vaccine, I'm like, oh, well, that's slightly different. You know what I'm trying to say is it helps knowing what is the actual risk to the pet. And listen, I just want to carry on with the comments because there's so many, we need to crack through.
I have got some figures for a cat one.
Okay. Before we get to the cat, can I quickly just read? So basically, CrossCat here has just said, I belong to a Facebook group about the dangers of Lepto-4 vaccines, which seems to affect small dogs more and is the worst offender. I believe Lepto-2 isn't really effective either. I gather that often the dog is infected with a strain not covered by the vaccines, and that even if it is, the vaccine is only effective for 3 months, thus leaving the dog unprotected for 9 months of the year. Pretty much what you've just said.
Yeah.
Right. And then she goes, what are the standard UK cat vaccines? My cat had vax at 2 months, then got a weird rash on the nose, which the dermatologist couldn't diagnose, then got vaxxed at 3 months, and at 6 months died nearly from heart failure, was put in an oxygen chamber, and was diagnosed with transient myocardial thickening and a raised troponin and gallop rhythm. And she's saying, you know, it looks like you can get myocarditis and ensuing heart failure, not just from COVID vaccines, but even these pet ones. So I think that's interesting.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the fact, sort of drawing a parallel to the human vaccine situation where, as you well know, that whole immunity from prosecution came in 1986. By definition, there is a official recognition that vaccines have adverse reactions. There is no such thing as 100% safe vaccine, that they all have a risk of an adverse reaction. And that's going to be the same in the animal ones too. So, you know, the adverse reactions are monitored by the VMD, the Veterinary Medicines Directive.
I was just about to ask you that. So they actually do. Okay.
So they do monitor it. But also you've got to bear in mind that the vaccine companies don't want to admit in cases where there have been a vaccine reaction.
Mm.
The vets don't want to admit that there's been an adverse reaction. And part of that is they became vets because they want to save animals, not cause harm.
Yeah.
And there's an element of, you don't want to think that you've been the cause of something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just natural human psychology. And, you know, everybody goes into medicine with that intention. And you know, we're caring people and we don't want to think that we're doing no harm. And obviously that whole Hippocratic oath of first do no harm. But, you know, everybody, whether they've sworn it or not, because I gather doctors don't even swear the Hippocratic Oath anymore.
Yeah.
That, you know, nobody wants to cause harm or to think that they've been the cause of harm. So, and you've also then got that situation where, because after vaccination has occurred, unless the adverse reaction is severe after the very first one, obviously once they started going out and walking about and about in the environment, then there is plausible deniability in terms of, well, how can you prove that it's the vaccine that's caused that?
Just
that,
like
that,
COVID.
That illness.
Mate, it's no different.
And
from COVID.
It is exactly the same. And that is the, you know, that's the attitude of the vaccine companies.
No, I get that.
And to a certain degree, you know, clinicians of all species will tend to have that thing of tending to recognize that as well. And because the adverse reaction rates recognized are so low, the probability says, you know, in their head that it's unlikely to have been the cause.
Roger, I'm going to be like quite succinct with this one because there's so many questions. I'm sorry.
Yep.
So it's going to be like bullet points. Boom, boom, boom.
Cool.
But just in a nutshell, 100% agree with what you just said, because it's just the same with humans. One, the doctor doesn't actually want to recognize that the vaccine caused it, because one, it's like a sacred cow. Vaccines are safe. They actually believe it themselves. It could be the vaccine. It's something else. It's coincidence or whatever. So they genuinely don't even see the correlation. There's a massive underreporting of vaccine injuries and adverse effects. And, you know, there's just like, you know, like you said, doctors go into medicine to heal people. The idea that they caused harm is something that is so profoundly disturbing that it doesn't even enter their mental capacity. Like, they're just like not recognizing it.
Yeah.
And I would assume it's the exact same with the vets.
Yeah.
So can we just quickly now talk about cats? You know, you did a great description of the things that happen to dogs and puppies and what the disease that they might be, you know, susceptible to. So same story again, you know, do it either way, vaccines and then diseases, or diseases and vaccines that affect cats. Can you help me with that one?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the same there, you've got core and non-core vaccinations, and the diseases are quite similar. So you've got cat flu, which is feline caliche virus. And you also, I know, fancy name. Eh? and you also got feline herpes virus, where you get, you know, rhinotracheitis, so nose and upper respiratory.
Is this a sexually transmitted disease? Are they just promiscuous?
No, it's a breathing one. It's a breathing one.
All right, okay.
And but also get ocular discharge as well. Yeah, you can see cats kissing. But it's primarily sort of upper respiratory and ocular. And then you get panleukopenia, which is the equivalent of, it's a parvovirus, so it's the equivalent of the dog one. And those are the core vaccinations. And then you've got a non-core, which is the feline leukemia virus. And this is the one I've actually got some figures for. So it's primarily a problem with cats that go out rather than house cats. And so the figures that I've got are 1-2% of the cat population are permanently infected. But once symptoms start showing, the majority die within 4 years. So that's your relative risk. So you,
no, but how many get symptoms? Is that 1% who are carrying the infection? How many actually get symptomatic and get problems?
I think it is the lot of the pretty well all of them that get it will get symptoms. But obviously, because there's then that sort of maybe 4 years or few years before they first manifest, there'll be And if you're in a built up situation where there's a lots of cats crossing paths and having fights and all the rest of it, then that's where it gets passed. So it's a tricky one. And obviously what sometimes happens if a cat is an outside cat and then it's diagnosed with FELV, you can't vaccinate against it because it's already got it. But then what do the owners do? They don't want, you know, really what they should do is make them house cats so they can't go out and infect others. But in the big wide world, you know, if you're a cat and you've been used to going out through your cat flap and roaming and hunting and doing all the things that cats do, you know, it's a big lifestyle change to then consider that actually you're going to have to be a house cat anymore and just look out the window. So, you know, there's a quality of life issue that is going to be perceived there as well. You know, I'm not a fan of house cats on that basis, although I understand it, because if you live on a busy road, the number of cats that unfortunately, you know, get killed on the road is, you know, it's a risk of that situation.
I get that.
But then, you know, how many I do, you know, having house that's cats that are, you know, restricted to houses only. I mean, they can play inside and they can be given mental stimulation and all the rest of it. And you could argue what they don't miss, they've never known they don't miss. But you do wonder what that sort of quality of life is. And I probably upset a hell of a lot of cat owners by saying that. But
for me, it's like being under house arrest. It's not nice.
Yeah.
So can I ask, okay, what about Metcalm, the, you know, meloxicam, the NS? And said, so, yeah. You know, again, CrossCat saying, you know, they're part of a Facebook group called Metcalm Kills, and it's very harmful, particularly to cats. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I mean, non-steroidals, they've always had a history can cause adverse reactions. And the classic one, obviously, is the stomach ulcer thing. You know, obviously they've been prescribed it because there's an inflammatory situation, usually some sort of arthritic situation for you know, Metcalm.
I guess the best way to avoid that is to go on a carnivore diet.
The idea, yeah, prevention is always better than cure. And if you're on the right species appropriate diet, then diseases like that don't happen. You know, I can't say that never, and I'm sure you will get animals, you know, lions and tigers and things in the wild, when they get older, because they've run around so much and possibly been injured during hunting and being kicked or trampled or had fights with others, then, you know, I'm sure arthritis does happen to a certain degree, but I'm sure it doesn't happen to the same extent that perhaps...
Have you seen many problems with this Metcalm?
I don't prescribe conventional drugs, so I don't really get involved.
Are you aware of it much, or any controversy around
it? It's not something that I've had people contact me about. You know, for the last 25 years, I've specialized in doing the alternative stuff that I do. A lot of it is musculoskeletal, but it's more performance related. You know, I've got my own remedies and things that I use for osteoarthritis and sort of old age conditions where, you know, obviously you've got to deal with it where you can. But my aim really is prevention is better than cure, and I try and get as many of my patients to, you know, on the raw feed diet as best as an early as possible for that reason.
I got some feedback. So remember I said to you after our last chat, oh my god, I'm not giving them a carnivore raw feed. I felt so guilty. I was like, oh my god, here I am, like, eating like mainly carnivore, and I'm like giving my cats this crap. We've managed to do it.
Cool.
Woohoo.
Yeah. Excellent. Well done.
Thanks, man.
Good boy. Pleasure.
Just thought I'd put it in there. Thanks. That's thanks to you. Right. Listen, Darren has said, what natural flea and tick preventions can you think of? And Anne Sikora said, Darren, check out wonderside.com. Any thoughts on any of this?
Gosh, fleas and ticks are...
You just rolled your eyes there.
It's... Because I've tried so many different natural things, and a lot of them, as my experience, haven't worked.
Do you know what? It's like bloody goddamn verrucas. You know, it's such a hard thing to treat.
Yeah.
You know, verrucas are so hard to treat. I'm just saying as a foot and ankle surgeon.
Yeah.
I've got one in the sole of my foot. And it's like, I've tried everything, freezing it, salicylic acid, pommel stone, yeah, everything. And it's just, anyway.
I've got a Swiss Army knife with me.
Yeah, well, let's do it. Let's gouge it out. So it sounds like this flea and tick thing is the same. So, I mean, what different natural treatments are there? Are there any? I mean, what's going on there?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there are probably various different essential oils. There are lots of products out there which claim to do stuff, and I've tried quite a few, and they haven't been totally successful. Now, Boots is 14, and
my dog, Boots, is my dog. Just in case, you know, yeah. People might not know, Boots is
my Patterdale Terrier, and he's my wingman, and so. To begin with, I used to use what was called a pet protector, which was a disc that he just wore on his collar, and it emitted a frequency that the fleas kept away from. And it lasted 4 years, and it worked. They save fleas and ticks, but I didn't. He very rarely got ticks or gets ticks anyway. So if he got a handful in a year, it's a bad year for him.
Have you ever seen a tick magnified under a microscope?
Oh, they're awesome, aren't they? I mean, they're arachnids, so they've got these amazing mouth parts and all the rest of it.
I don't know about amazing. It's
and they can be
fracking disgusting.
I know, and they've got all sort of different sizes, so you can almost get, like, you know, tiny ones that you can hardly see, and then obviously ones where you can obviously see them. And
they are as alien as you can get. Yeah. Right? I mean, I'm just going to share my screen now. Dude, what the hell, man? I find them, they're just so alien.
Yeah, no, they're pretty gross.
Ugh.
So, but he did get the odd tick when he had his disc on. So I wasn't convinced that they helped for ticks the same way that they definitely helped for fleas. And then after about 8 years of wearing it, so it suddenly stopped working. And I thought, time to get another one, you know. So I got another one and it didn't work. And since then, I've struggled to find something that I would absolutely hang my hat on and say this definitely works. I've tried herbs.
By the way, I can just hear the audience now going, oh, no.
No, absolutely. You know, I'm with them. I would love to be able to say, oh yeah, I've got the magic bullet for fleas. And I think to a certain degree, even with the conventional chemicals, which I hate, you know, the fleas have become a lot more resistant to them as well. We sort of selected for them, whereas the spot on treatments used to be one every 3 months. And now they're saying it's one a month, you know,
really?
Once a month. So the fleas have definitely become more tolerant. And so they've effectively upped the dosage. But there's no, you know, if a flea spot on treatment goes on the back of the neck and then spreads out to the rest of the body, it's not just going in the skin, it's going throughout all the organs and the rest of it.
Yeah.
And obviously there've been worries about how those chemicals going into, going into rivers for dogs that like swimming and things like that. And how many insects in the environment get killed, to the point where some other countries have banned these chemicals.
Oh wow.
But I don't see why, just because we're treating naturally, you know, eventually, you know, they're still insecticidal. So to a certain degree, why wouldn't fleas adapt to being resistant to those as much as they can?
What is NexGard, by the way?
There's just a whole different range of different manufacturers got very similar products that have got all the different chemicals in them
do you know what the chemicals are?
And off the top of my head.
All right. Okay. And, all right, fine. And Ingrid,
nice.
Ingrid says that they're taking ivermectin for heartworm, her dog.
Yeah.
Is that quite common? Heartworm? That sounds disgusting. What? A worm inside your heart?
Yeah.
Is that literally what it is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are you fracking joking?
No, you can see that when they're big adults, you can see
that. Is this just a thing that affects... What the hell? Is this a thing that just affects dogs?
There are probably other species that get heartworm as well.
We don't get heartworms.
Well, maybe not in this country.
Worm in your heart. Dude, that's freaking me out. That actually happens in dogs.
Yes, but it's rare. It's pretty rare in the UK.
Why the hell is a worm living there?
Well, it's just that's where it goes to. I mean, well, it's good food, I suppose, isn't it? It's in the bloodstream, and it lays its eggs, and then the larvae sort of go out.
Is it got like, you know, like June, that June worm, like lots of serrated teeth?
No, they all look like that.
It's plugged in one end and like floating in the river, in the bloodstream, and letting off the eggs.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's disgusting. Do you know what really freaks me out going back to ticks? Can you imagine a tick the size of a human? Can you just imagine how fracking disgusting that would be? A little teeth and mouth part. Freak me out.
Yeah. Do you think dinosaurs had them that size?
These ticks?
We just don't know, do we?
We just don't know.
You wouldn't find it. Because there's no bones, you won't find a sort of fossilized tick, will you?
No. God, imagine human-sized tick. Bloody hell. Jeez. Right, okay.
There's a film there somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. Right, Juliet, that would be my initial. No, let's hold on. She said her cats didn't like the chemical stuff being put on.
No.
She's saying, I'm thinking there must be more natural solutions to the flea and mite or tick issue. Okay, Liz Rigby. I mean, going back to vaccines a bit, it's kind of sad, but I think it's worth hearing.
Yep.
She goes, why do vets recommend a yearly vaccine? We lost our perfectly healthy Patterdale 5 years ago. The vaccine collapsed our immune system. We now have a one-year-old whippet who will never be vaccinated, but vets still push it. What do you think of that one?
I don't think annual vaccination would be justified at all. The vets, to a certain degree, are caught between a rock and a hard place on vaccination, because I'd say most vaccines, I think nearly all of them now, have got a 3-yearly recommendation, so once every 3 years. The problem with the vets have, and there is evidence to suggest, as I said, that vaccination once given as a puppy will last at least 7 years, if not for life. And the fact that there is a certain degree of challenge in the environment will keep giving natural boosters, and we can talk about titer testing because that's often misinterpreted as well. And so I would say there is no justification for doing it on a medical basis. But unfortunately, there are legislative and other reasons why annual vaccination gets pushed. Part of it is a lot of the local authority legislation that governs licenses for kennels and for dog sitters and dog walkers and those sorts of officially registered businesses requires that their dogs are vaccinated and are up to date with vaccination. And they define it within their legislation as being annually vaccinated. And so the people whose livelihoods depend on dog sitting or dog walking or having your dog while you're on holiday, their livelihood, if they're inspected and they've got dogs on the premises where the vaccination isn't up to date, as regarded by the authority, will get their businesses closed down. And so they are under pressure. It's more than their job's worth to not have that, you know, to take dogs which haven't been vaccinated to that degree. So the problem you've got is the data sheet will say they've got to be given every 3 years. And because we know that the vaccines aren't 100% covering, there is risk to getting diseases, even if they've been vaccinated against that disease.
Mm.
If the vet has said, okay, you've had your puppy vax, adults are very, very unlikely to get serious disease, life-threatening disease, so we don't necessarily have to carry on doing vaccines for the rest of their life. If that dog or cat were to become immunosuppressed for whatever reason and then get that disease, then the owners could turn around to the vet and go, you should have told me to vaccinate that. You should have told me to booster that. And I'm going to sue you. And so the vets are caught. And because society has got that much more litigious, and even though I'm sure you've had it, you tell someone the relative risks of a procedure, they accept it, they understand it, so they say, and then you do it and it doesn't quite happen. They, you know, when their health is on the line, or their pet's health is on the line, or there's money on the line, they will quite happily turn around and go, okay, I'm going to sue you now. And the vet has got no defense, because the data sheet says it's got to be jabbed every 3 years, and they haven't done it.
Okay.
So there are political reasons, if you like, legislative reasons why it's, it,
and I would
it's
say,
not cut and dried.
And I would also say professional pressures. So basically, I agree with Sandra. She's saying, I'm hearing scientists say antibodies aren't the whole story anyway regarding immunity, that in fact, high antibody levels can be a bad thing. An innate immunity actually plays a bigger role in disease prevention than is acknowledged. Unfortunately, there isn't funding or proper investigation into how the immune system works, but it's so beneficial to the pharmaceutical industry to stick with the vaccine model. At this stage, we might ask whether vaccines actually even work to prevent diseases. I'm actually with her. I'm with her. And I'll be honest with you, again, I'll put my flag down and say, you know, I'm not buying this whole vaccine industry business. You know, I need to be convinced. And at this moment in time, I'm not. So, yeah, that's where I stand. Anyway, let's move on. So, where are we? Yeah, this
there's
is
an answer to that, then.
Marge Dawes. I recently read that the EU are exploring the possibilities of injecting livestock with mRNA vaccinations. What are the implications of this to humans regarding the food chain, i.e. beef, lamb, pork? Is this true?
There has certainly been a declaration that they wish to move animal jabs over to the mRNA platform. The current situation is that there are no mRNA jabs currently authorized in the UK and Europe, to my knowledge. There is only one in the USA, which is licensed for pigs, and amazingly somehow got its license in 2018 before the vaccine definition was changed.
Oh wow.
To allow it.
Yeah. Interesting.
Is there a threat? Absolutely. Because one of the potential things that mRNA itself can cause is prion seeding. So it will start protein misfolding in the body. And prions, as we know from BSE mad cow disease, if it was to happen in cattle, we could end up with our food being potentially contaminated. And I can go into that in more detail. So, and the other way that protein misfolding can be seeded can be viral proteins and even viral infections. And so if a protein is chosen, and because these jabs are being pushed through so quickly, no safety checks are being done adequately, then the body could be forced to make a protein which they have no idea if it's going to cause, prion formation. And likewise, as we found with the human ones, you know, if there's a frame shifting, then they might even be producing proteins that they don't even know that they're producing.
What do you mean by frame shifting?
So because pseudouridine is used instead of uracil in the mRNA products to make them more stable, ribosomes read the mRNA, but what happens with frame shifting is effectively exactly what it says. There's three different codon, three amino acids for each, three bases of nucleotide for an amino acid. And so if that's misread and it basically shifts along a frame, as it were, then you're going to get the wrong sequence of nucleotides and the wrong amino acid chosen. And then you could effectively make a novel protein which could have prion activity or other activity in the body that was unintended, because they don't even anticipate that the body was going to produce that protein in the first place. So there are dangers from that. There's dangers from the lipid nanoparticles, as we know. They can set up inflammation and cause all sorts of problems there. So yes, there are implications for our animals if the jabs get moved over, and there are potential dangers for our food. And that And I say that widely rather than just our meat, because there has been recent research that shows that if prions go into the environment, so for example, they gave a cattle an mRNA vaccination and they produce prions and it gets excreted out in the urine, in the feces. If that's then used as slurry to fertilize crops, what they've discovered is if prions go into the soil, plants can uptake prions with their roots and redistribute it into the leaves. So potentially even plants could become infected with prions.
That's a shit show, literally.
It's a shit show, literally. And although eating one Brussels sprout won't kill you, honestly, kids, but if you keep eating, you know, vegetables that have been, you know, got prions in them, they become cumulative. And that is, you know, so there is a potential danger. And of course, if it goes into the environment, then it can go into the water.
I've said this before, but again and again, the whole mRNA platform is just a disaster and it needs to be stopped. Train crash literally happening in front of us. Right, next question, my friend. So someone has said, Linda Taylor, what's the treatment of arthritis in older dogs? My vet keeps pushing this monthly injection, which I've resisted. Oh, what's that? Resisted so far. What natural treatments can I use already giving omega-3?
Yeah, I mean, arthritis, again, it's been around for a long time. And there's, you know, it's always traditionally been, you know, the Metacam, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories.
What's the injection they're getting?
Yeah, it's happened fairly recently, but it's, you know, the idea is it's a once a month injection
of,
I'm not sure what the active ingredient is. I've got my own remedies and things that I use for osteoarthritis. I've got a bioresonance formula that I had a lot of good feedback from. And I've done it quite a number of years now, so it's like homeopathy, but it's, you know, it just comes in a little lactose tablet.
Bioresonance.
Yeah.
What is it?
Bioresonance. It's like computerized homeopathy. So once you understand that we're all made of frequency and energy, then everything on the planet effectively has the potential, it has its own signature based on its constituent molecules. And you can, so you can make a remedy from anything. So my bioresonance kit has got 227,000 different remedies choice within it. And within that, I've chosen remedies that I recognize or are recognized by homeopathy, acupuncture, and all the rest of it to be useful for arthritis. And I've combined them all into one formula.
I have no idea what you're talking about, mate. I've just gotten like, where can people read more about this stuff? You should do a Substack on it.
Maybe, yes, I will do a Substack on it.
You should do a Substack on this and write about it. And is there any literature, any evidence, any research, any background?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we are frequency, physics.
I know that, explaining what this thing, bioresonance, you said like 270,000 options or what, I mean, like, where can people read about this stuff?
On my website.
Okay, anywhere else?
Well, I'll do a Substack for it.
Anywhere else?
Well, I mean, there's bioresonance has been used for quite a number of years. So there's quite a few different manufacturers who do bioresonance kit. But it is just basically using energy and frequency as an informational way of influencing the body and getting the body to self-heal. So, I mean, it's sort of the oldest form is homeopathy.
But we don't actually know how homeopathy works. We don't know if it's memory in the water. No one. I've had experts on homeopathy and they all say the same thing. We don't know how homeopathy works.
It's water memory.
I know. You said that very confidently, but everybody says we don't know. It could potentially be water memory.
I think, well,
could
I
be
mean,
quantum the, levels. We don't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah, I mean, but it's still, even if it is happening on the quantum level, it's still the water is still the link to that, to that quantum level. So I would say, yes, it is primarily sort of water memory and the frequency of that. And, you know, Luc Montagnier did some experiments where he took the frequency of DNA and he was able to transfer, long story short, he was able to transfer it even by email to another computer on another continent, and then they used that frequency to get a protein to reconstitute, and they checked it with PCR, and it was, I think it was 99% accurate in terms of reproducing the protein. So the memory of water is proven.
It's fascinating.
But so I, you know, that's how it's working.
Okay, it's funny. This is a very interesting comment from Circa C. I hope that's the right way of pronouncing it. She goes, I've never taken my dog to the vet. No vaccine, nothing. I dread the day we need to go in for some stupid emergency, but I'm basically treating him like myself. Good food, exercise, and no doctor. Good luck. And it's funny, I actually subscribe to that. I think the way to stay healthy is stay away from doctors. The way to stay, keep your teeth healthy is stay away from dentists. You go to see a dentist, they're going to say you need a filling. I saw Simon King this Monday. He's former chiropractor, does something called afferentology, very alternative. And he said, look, you know, come on, I love your podcast. You know, this is what I do. And I was like, I have no idea what afferentology is. Like, what the hell? Like, what is it? Because it's something only he's made up, okay? And he said, well, the best way to do it would be to demonstrate it. And I was like, all right, well, I'll go down and have a look. And he only lives 30 minutes away. So I went to his little wee clinic, and he looked in my teeth, in my mouth, and looked at my teeth, because apparently one of the things he wants to see is if I've got fillings, called metal fillings, can cause an afferent problem and then a subsequent muscular problem and neurological. And it kind of makes sense to me. And he was demonstrating videos how people's fillings and how pressure on them, or how taking the fillings away would change motor function and power. Absolutely fascinating. He also did a manipulation on me, which was interesting. I have to admit, my back feels quite good now. I don't know if it's a mental thing or not, but for the last few days, back feels quite good. Where am I going with this? But basically, he was saying to me, I can't believe you don't have any fillings. And I was like, well, it all goes down to the fact that my dentist, when I was in med school, said to me, I'm retiring this year. Son, never go see a dentist again. Your teeth are amazing. If you go see a dentist, they'll put a filling in it. And he was right. You know, I think, you know, one of the best things is to stay away from doctors, stay away from dentists, unless you really need it, unless there's a problem. And I kind of agree with Circa, same with pets. Like, you can stay away from a vet, keep them away from it. Maybe it's a good thing. Now, you might disagree with me. This is where I'll ask you, should you be taking your pet for an annual checkup? And, you know, should you be seeing a routine kind of vet thing? Or should you just leave it? And if there's a problem, then go and see and take them.
I absolutely agree with what you're saying. Yeah, you know, my aim when I work is to get my patients well, to cure them, that cure word that we're not allowed to use or supposed to use, so that they don't have to see me again. That is the perfect result.
So you're an ethical vet and a shit businessman.
Yeah, correct. I don't know why am I laughing.
Because otherwise you cry.
True. But it's true. But I absolutely agree with what she's saying. But there are provisos around that.
Yes, of course.
And one is obviously eat the right food. And unfortunately, the vast majority of our pets are not being fed the right food.
Yeah.
And I'd say even a lot of the raw, I'm going to be really controversial now, I'd say a lot of the raw feeders aren't doing it right either. Since I've gone carnivore, I am so much more aware of what a problem plants cause in the diet. And you've got to then think, well, what's the definition of a poison? Is it something that kills you in 5 minutes? Or like you know, if a cow eats a bit of you, you'll see it in its mouth. It's died that blooming quickly because the cyanide's in it. Or is it something that causes disease, that causes illness, and it might take 10 years to manifest.
Slow poisoning. Well, we know
and it's a slow poison.
We know people have been poisoned with arsenic slowly. You know, yeah. I mean, you can do that.
So from that point of view, if you fundamentally accept that the vast majority of animals are on a diet which is leading them towards ill health over whatever period of time, then the annual check model in terms of catching that disease as early as possible makes sense from that paradigm. And then obviously you end up then being taken down the road of having to, you know, well, obviously the allopathic road is symptom suppression rather than actually sorting out the root cause of the disease. And that's how medical schools, human and veterinary, have been taught to function. But once you go down sort of the natural route and you recognize prevention is better than cure, and we are what we eat and all those idioms that we've all heard and recognize, then, you know, getting everything on the correct diet right from the get-go is by far the best way of preventing disease. And if you do it, and if you do it properly, then absolutely you've got a very good chance of not having to go to a vet. And that's also the flip side of that is vets tend to only see animals, apart from their annual checkup, that are showing symptoms of disease. Mm. And so conventional vets don't get that perspective on the raw feeding in terms of how much it prevents health, because they don't see the animals. They only see problems when something goes wrong.
It's the same with doctors.
And then they assume that the raw diet, or they like to try and make out that the raw diet has caused the problem, regardless of whether it's got any potential link at all, which is crazy, but it goes on. And yeah, it's so, absolutely agree with her 100%, but you've got to do the diet right, and it's got to be strict.
Okay. Right. Listen, so this kind of comes to, I think, the raw food diet. Yeah. I just want to say a couple of other things. Patricia says, are the annual vaccines for dogs merited in any way, or just a big pharma cash cow? I think we've got the answer now. I don't think we need to say anything more there. Nikki Torbett, vaccinations. We're getting a puppy soon, and I'm wary about getting it jabbed. Are vaccines really necessary, and are there natural methods that can be used? I mean, I don't think we need, I mean, we've covered that a little bit, but are there any natural treatments for these conditions? And if so, what for dogs and cats?
Okay, so there are things called homeopathic nosodes, which are wrongly called homeopathic vaccines, which they aren't, because that's not how they work.
What are they called? Homeopathic?
Nosodes. So a nosode is a homeopathic dilution of the disease. So either disease material or the pathogen itself that has been diluted down to a homeopathic level. So you've just got the memory, the information, the vibration of that disease. And the way that homeopathic nosodes work is if they are given whilst the animal is being challenged with the pathogen, it allows the immune system to seroconvert, so to gain natural immunity without showing symptoms. So the two scenarios in that, one is you give the nosode, the dog or cat encounters that pathogen and they get a natural immunity, which is what you want. It's the best sort of immunity, and they don't show any symptoms. The flip side of that is you give them the nosode, they don't meet the pathogen, so there is no immune seroconversion. They do not have a natural immunity, and then you obviously don't show any symptoms for it either. And so you stop giving the nosode, and then the animal encounters the pathogen. So if they've already encountered it whilst they've been getting the nosode, their immune system is already primed and it will deal with that pathogen and they won't get diseased.
Mm.
If they haven't encountered the pathogen whilst they've been getting the course of the nosode, then they are still immunologically naive. And that's where you'll get conventional vets going, well, hope nosodes don't work. And it's like, no, they don't understand how they work. They haven't worked because the animal didn't meet the pathogen at the time the nosode was being given. And of course, if the nosode has been given and they've seroconverted and they met it, they're never going to get ill. So they're not going to see the vets of those situations. So, and then you get people who will then perhaps get a titer test done. So looking for antibody levels, and they'll say, oh yeah, I gave the nosode and here's my dog has got a titer for this condition. Therefore the homeopathic nosode gave it. And it's like, no, it didn't. The nosode covered the symptoms was the body was naturally seroconverting and getting its immune response to it. So it wasn't the nosode that caused the titer test. It just allowed the natural immunity to occur whilst the animal was being covered. So you can give them, but again, because of those scenarios, there is a risk to nosodes because you don't know whether they've encountered the pathogen, the same as there's a risk to giving vaccines. You could still end up at the end of both of them with a dog that's actually, or a cat that's actually still immunologically naive, because not all vaccines will take anyway.
All right. Yvonne Daly says, it would appear you need a PhD in canine nutrition if you dare say you cook them food yourself or feed them raw, yet no one stops you feeding your kids McDonald's all day long if you want. What would a balanced diet look like for two fussy cockapoos? Also, I titer test every year, but is this even necessary considering initial vaccines could last a lifetime? Thanks. So let's talk about the cockapoos. What's the balanced diet? What would that look like for them?
Same as it does for any other breed of dog. It's raw meaty bones. So, raw meat on bone. So
which meat?
You can give chicken, so chicken carcasses, chicken legs, chicken drumsticks, chicken thighs, chicken wings, if you take the little tips off, because they can be not lot, there's no real meat on them and they can be quite sharp. Breast of lamb, rabbit, game birds, you know, deer, venison, but ideally you want the meat and the bone.
So not beef.
Beef is fine, but again, you know, probably the leg bones have been supporting 700 kilos of cow, so they're very dense.
So bone is important for them?
Yes, it's where they get their minerals from, and it also keeps their teeth clean. And this is why I have a big problem with pre-ground, but that's another subject, sorry. diet fulfills a chemical requirement, but it also has a physical requirement, and that is keeping teeth and gums clean. You know, teeth are designed, as your friend was saying, you know, teeth are designed to kill you. If you get them wrong, that's what happens. And it sounds like an out of the, you know, OTT statement. But if you don't look after your teeth properly, eventually they will kill you, get abscesses, or, you know, if they're hunting, then, you know, if it's too sore to chew properly, or actually you've got a smelly breath, then, you aren't going to hunt very well if you're, prey can smell you coming. So, you know, the teeth are designed ultimately to, you know, to lead to the end. So it's important that we look after them. And for cats and dogs, crunching bones, chewing bones, and having those teeth worked properly and working the gums as well, so that you get that gum tooth margin really strong, is important too, because otherwise if they're not physically stimulated enough, the gum margin will weaken, and then you can get ulcers below the gum line that you can't see. The teeth look clean, but they're still getting infection in there.
So there's a lot of people that are selling like meat, but it's mushed up meat.
Yeah, bad practice.
Bad practice. So you think just go straight to bones, just get them little chicken bones and get them feeding on the cats and dogs?
Absolutely.
All right, well, listen, I have to be an honest confession. We're at the ground meat stage right now. We haven't got fully to the bony.
That's fine.
But we at least got them off the... Next time, it'll be...
it is a transition, as I said, you know, said before.
But it makes sense. Now that I hear you saying it, I mean, honestly, it makes sense. You know, like, they're meant to be using their mouth, their jaws, their teeth, their gums, biting, gnawing, tearing, not eating mushy patty.
Exactly. But, you know, sometimes you do have to do it gradually.
Transition. They're not changing gender. They're just changing diet.
Exactly. But, and it can even cause, I mean, I think they're even saying in humans now, they're getting soft jaw bones, the density of the jaw bones too. So that will have that
effect. They've got that recessed jaw. They have that recessed jaw. They have problems with mouth breathing. Their teeth get crooked. You have to have your teeth removed because you're not eating proper food. You're not chewing and gnawing. You're just eating mush.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and, our cats and dogs are the same. So,
anyway, let's go to the titer test. I mean, I think we've covered the raw thing. It's actually incredibly simple.
Yeah.
Really, honestly, it's just very simple.
It is.
Right, okay. So what about the titer test? Do they need that every year or not? Sounds like a no.
Okay, so we've got to understand titer tests, which unfortunately I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about them out there.
This is another Substack coming.
This is another Substack coming, yeah. So titer tests are basically a measure of your immune challenge. And the reason why I say that is because they're measuring antibodies and there is no measure of memory cells within there.
Yes.
So if you have...
And it's non-specific.
Yeah. So if you've got an antibody for example, parvovirus, okay, for whatever, however you got that in the first place, whether you did it with nosodes, natural infection, or vaccination, which will last up to a certain degree, then testing, looking at antibody levels for it will tell you what the current strain is, or what the current challenge is. Because if you're not being challenged, your body goes, okay, don't need to make antibodies anymore because I've got memory cells. So the antibody levels will fall. But it doesn't mean you haven't got antibodies at all. It doesn't mean you aren't immunocompetent. It just means you're not being challenged, which is fine. Because if your environment isn't challenging you on a regular basis, why do you need to be boosted? You don't, because your body's saying this is the antibody level that I'm happy with in my environment on a day-to-day basis. I have memory cells. If I get challenged by going somewhere I don't normally walk, or if a dog comes along that's suddenly shedding and I get a stronger challenge, my immune system is more than capable of gearing up and producing them. So I don't think boosters are required. Unfortunately, there seems to be this idea that you've got to have all your antibody levels at a certain level to be covered. It's like, well, that's not true at all. And the reason why I'd say vaccination has some effect is because, as you say, it isn't giving the strongest, best immunity, but it does give some immunity for a short period of time. But that's sufficient to then get those kittens and puppies to being adulthood, and then their own environment will decide what level of antibody they need thereafter. The problem we've got in humans is that some of those childhood diseases are supposed to be met in childhood, and mumps is the classical example. So what's happening now is they're given a mumps vaccine, and it does give some degree of cover, but because it's not the proper immunity that's properly lasting, what you've done is you've shifted that time when they're susceptible to for meeting mumps from being a child where it has fairly inconsequential. They get over it pretty quickly, get some big glands in their throat and they get over it pretty quickly. But then you've shifted it, especially in guys, to when they're sexually mature and it is really serious for them. Mm. And that is, so vaccines, I would say vaccines do have some effect, but it's not in the right way.
Yeah.
And it then ultimately leaves them naive at a point in their life where they should already have met it and have proper immunity. And that's the danger.
So, you know what? This is a very similar one. I might be wrong, full disclosure, but I think my understanding is the flu jabs that we're doing to the kids are the same. So, yeah, it might superficially make them appear like they're having less flu, but they're still got symptoms, they're milder, or they're more susceptible to other infections like RSV, yeah, other problems, other respiratory infections. So my impression as time goes by is rather than vaccines being this thing that boosts your immunity, it actually impairs your immunity. You know, it's not natural. It's a very unnatural thing we've introduced. And we think that we're so clever and we're tinkering and we're making the human body better. Actually, it's not counterproductive. And what we're doing is we're impairing the immune system. And part of that then is why we're seeing things like autoimmune conditions, allergies, and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, that's just my thoughts on the matter. You might like some of the next few questions, by the way. So again, Yvonne goes, what's going on in the US regarding kibble? Many dogs are sick or dying and owners are blaming it on mold and rotten meat from the abattoirs. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah.
Sounds like another Substack.
Yeah, it is. It is potentially, although it's ongoing at the moment. So this is something which started in sort of December last year, where they started dogs and
what is kibble, by the way?
Kibble is the little biscuits.
Okay. So that's how ignorant I am. I don't give my kids, cats. I definitely don't give my kids kibble, but I don't give my cats kibble either. So I don't know what it is.
Yeah, chicken nuggets equivalent. Yeah.
Oh, is that? My kids don't get that either.
Pleased to hear it. But obviously it's all biscuit, isn't it? So certain dogs are getting vomiting, diarrhea, bleeding out of both ends as a result of seizures. Some of them, obviously the more severe ones, are dying.
Oh God.
And so there's about 10 or dozen feeds now implicated. There is no official recognition, no official food recalls going on. There's been a couple of vets more on the natural side in the States who have recognized the problem. There is one, Dr. Judy Morgan, who is actually spending her own money, spending thousands of dollars trying to do testing on the feeds to try and find out what's going on. Unfortunately, I think she's wasting her money because she went out and bought.
Judy, is it Judy Morgan?
Yeah. So she bought some brands which she'd heard these reports from and then started testing that, but they wouldn't necessarily be the right batches because different batches of different ingredients. Unfortunately, the way a lot of these compounded foods for small animals as well as horses and cattle are formulated is they've got, you know, a requirement, if you like, for the end product in terms of protein, carbs, analysis from a chemical point of view. And so what will happen is when they're being made in the factory, they will be compounded using ingredients of the lowest cost formula calculated to give that end composition. So, and obviously different raw materials are coming from different countries or from wherever. And so only some batches of feed will be affected. So if you're not testing the right batch, then the trouble is you then when you're looking for a toxin, you've got to know what you're looking for. You can't just put it in for a toxin scan and it will scan it and go, oh yeah, look, it's this weird and wonderful thing. You've actually got to sort of ask for specific tests for specific toxins. And so she could be testing a batch which is actually hasn't got these in it, and then
to me,
and then ruling that out. And
the simplest thing to me is like, don't feed your dogs.
Well,
and pets this shit.
I would agree. Yeah.
Just stay away from it.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, listen. Before we get to Peter Laurie, a farmer. Well, he's a listener.
Yeah.
And a supporter.
Yeah.
And a former guest.
Well, hey.
Whoa. So he actually emailed me out of the blue one day and said, I've got a few things that I want to just say to you. What do you think? Your thoughts on this? And I read his email. I was like, oh my God, I'd love to have you on as a guest. And he was like, I'm just a nobody. I was like, I love nobodies. No one's a nobody. No one is a nobody. So anyway, Peter Laurie's got a question we're going to come to next.
Yep.
Curveball. You'll like this one.
Okay.
You'll like this one. But before we get to that, I need to go and take a piss.
Okay.
My bladder's like, meh. So I'm going to pause and then we restart. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Are you having fun?
I'm having fun.